Hi there, Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain. Hope you're doing well. I'm back, baby. So I'm going to be debating in Nashville, September the 12th, 2026. So I hope you'll join me there. I'm going to be there all weekend. Lots of meets and greets, chats, and I'd love to meet you, shake your hand, find out what good and ill philosophy has done for you. So there's going to be Nashville, of course. September the 12th is the actual debate. I'll be around all weekend, and you can go to wordwardebate.com. That's wordwardebate.com. Get your tickets. Not very expensive. It's going to be a fantastic night. I'm back. I'm true to form, and I have more than half a decade of pent-up public speaking energy to unleash on the crowd. So you'll get a Richard Dreyfuss side tan if you turn away. All right. So probably going to get to one question today. There's a bunch of questions that have come in, and I'm going to leap into the first question here. This is the Lindsay Clancy case. And let's talk about Lindsay Clancy, and then I will get to the question just so I can give you some sort of some background on this. So Lindsay Clancy built a seemingly idyllic life with her husband and three young children, all under the age of six, in Duxbury, Massachusetts. However, prosecutors allege that image was shattered in January 2023 when Clancy brutally strangled her children to death. Clancy, 35, is accused of three counts of first-degree murder, and there's a big trial that's underway, and it was delayed for a while. Of course, she's facing a mandatory life sentence if convicted of the murder charges. While prosecutors claim her actions were deliberate, Clancy has pleaded not guilty to all charges, and her defense team contends she suffered from undiagnosed postpartum psychosis at the time of the killings. Now a jury will decide, blah, 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 blah. Okay, she was born, the mother, Lindsay, August 11th, 1990. Raised in Connecticut, she attended a rigorous accelerated nursing program at Massachusetts General Hospital. Then worked as a labor and delivery nurse at the facility for 9 years. I don't want to say anything bad about nurses, because I suppose I'm going to be dependent on them someday, but nurses in general, I think the Latin phrase is a TFN. Nurses in general are totally freaking nuts. People in the, women in particular, in the helping professions, are generally not well themselves. A lot of therapists have mental disorders. So a lot of times people want to go and heal others to avoid the need to heal themselves, right? So they try to bring other people to reality, and they get a certain amount of vanity. It tends to distance themselves from their own problems. So again, I don't know anything about her as a person other than what we're reading here. But I think I went on one date with one nurse and I was like, whoa, you are not deeply in reality. Plus, of course, it generally is a redirect, not in this case because she had three kids. In general, pets, causes, ideology, and sympathy for outsiders is all just a sort of perverted and misdirected maternal instinct and so on. So I think it's interesting. She worked as a labor and delivery nurse for 9 years, which means she was around a lot of pregnant women. She was around a lot of babies and so on, right? So she's not like, it's not like she had no experience with pregnancy and childbirth and then got caught by surprise by her own experiences. So I thought that was interesting. So December 2016, Lindsay married Patrick Clancy. The couple had three children, Cora Dawson and Callan. Susan Clancy, Patrick's mother, said she was a fun-loving, doting wife and mother. She loved her kids and she was a nurturing mother who smiled all the time. Ooh, hoo, 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 hoo. It's your first warning sign. Oh, yes, that is your very, very first warning sign, which is that people are saying what is sentimental and what they wish were true rather than what is actually true. So they got married in 2016, and then it was six and change years later when she murdered, or allegedly, I think she murdered, but she's admitted that she murdered them. But she's saying she did it because she was psychotic. So this means that Patrick, her husband, let's assume they dated for a while, let's say a year or two before they got married. So that means that his mother, Susan Clancy, Patrick's mother. It means that his mother knew this woman who suffered from significant, extreme mental health issues. We get more into the medication side in a bit. But she had serious problems. Those problems don't generally come out of nowhere. It's very unusual for someone to be diagnosed with schizophrenia in their 30s. It's normally a sort of 16 to 24 kind of age range. But what it means is that she's saying, oh, she was wonderful. She was lovely. She smiled all the time. She was the best. She was the greatest and so on. Now, hey, I mean, it's tough to comment on these kinds of things. I get it. But this woman annihilated your bloodline, like the right, if this is what happened, right? So, of course, you know, I want to be clear. These alleged, just take it for granted. Nothing's, you know, until it's proven in a court of law, innocent until proven guilty and so on. But, you know, it seems to be the case. So if you've ever been around people, boy, this is a tough one, man. If you've ever been around people like the Blanche DuBois kind of characters, the Willie Loman kind of characters from Streetcar Named Desire and Death of a Salesman, respectively, is Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller. I'm telling you, man, those people who desperately will for the ideal rather than the real, very dangerous, right? Very dangerous people to be around as a whole, because they wish for things to be a certain way. They have sentimentality about things a certain way. And then when reality confronts them, they get aggressive. Always. They'll try and be nice, but if you keep pushing, you get this willed, angry rage at the root. I'm not talking about this woman in particular. I don't know her before. But in terms of I've dealt with a lot of people who are embedded in unreality over the last 45 years of philosophy. So I've dealt with a lot of people embedded in unreality. And if you push them on their unreality, you get this kind of cold rage. I mean, you just saw this with, was it Dana Bash and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did some CNN interview where she was just spewing the most mindless NPC pharmaceutical big corporation bribed and programmed propaganda. And he was pushing back with facts and she just gets colder and then wants to change the subject. Cornering people who are devoted to profitable delusions with actual facts, they view you as a predator. They view you as, you know, it's fall, the farmer's getting his crops in, and you're just setting fire to all of his crops, and thus his family will not make it through the winter. Once people become addicted to unreality, bringing the truth to them turns you into a kind of very dangerous predator that they will fight to the death to avoid or dismantle. So nobody smiles all the time, right? So it's, oh, she was wonderful, she was nurturing, she was amazing, she was beautiful, she smiled all the time. That's not true. It can't be true. My wife is just about the happiest person that I know. She doesn't smile all the time. She doesn't smile all the time. She smiles while climbing stairs. She smiles while having sex. She smiles while doing her taxes. She smiles when stubbing her toe. Like, what is that? The horror movie? Like the smile thing. So, okay, smiles all the time. I know it's a hyperbole and you don't take it totally. She smiles in her sleep. She smiles at the dentist and the dentist can't fix her teeth because she's just smiling. So I get that it's hyperbole, but that is an unreality to begin with. So if the mother of the husband of the woman who's alleged to have killed her children, if the mother is addicted to unreality, then her son, if he hasn't confronted that in his mother, will be helpless in the face of his wife's unreality. Did you see what I mean? If you conform to the unreality of your mother, how can you resist the unreality of your wife? Because there's a foundational principle. You conform to female unreality. And again, I'm not trying to, you know, go deep into, I can't diagnose anyone. This is just my sort of thoughts about this level of really addicted hyper-sentimentality. Oh, she was the best. She was wonderful. She smiled all the time. She was the greatest. Blah, blah, blah. Not true. But if the son was raised with that, and I don't know if they're Christian, I would put a huge bet if I was a betting man on the fact that they are Christian for reasons I'll get into. But a lot of Christians have this performative aspect to them. It's true of other religions. I know a little bit more about the Christian side of things. They have this performative aspect of things where things can't be wrong, because if things go wrong, that's kind of like a punishment from God. So everything has to be good. Everything has to be perfect. Everything has to be great and wonderful and lovely and so on, because unhappiness is like a sin, because if you're deep in your faith, you're happy. And if you're unhappy, that means that you've drifted from faith, you lose status points in the religious community. And so there's this absolutely, you know, white-lipped, white-knuckled, hanging on for grim death to all signs of positivity and happiness and everything's great and so on. And that means that you're good with the Lord and you're walking the path of righteousness and you're in the full flower of your benevolent faith and you just can't have problems, because problems are kind of like a sin. So Lindsay began experiencing postpartum anxiety following the birth of both Cora and Dawson. Those are the first two kids. After Dawson's birth, she managed her symptoms with exercise, meditation, and therapy. After Callan's birth, however, the symptoms grew in severity. Now, if her mother-in-law had said, "We were very concerned that things were going badly, she did seem to be unhappy," and so on. So if her mother-in-law is saying everything was great, she was a wonderful doting mother, she smiled all the time, it means that her son, right, the mother-in-law of the woman, her son and her daughter-in-law were keeping secrets from her. They weren't bringing the facts, they weren't bringing the reality, they weren't bringing the truth, because she struggled with significant anxiety and then psychosis, which is a true detachment from reality. Look, obviously, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or anything like that. I'm just a moral philosopher. But the way that I sort of divide mental issues are, do you have a problem with your internal state, or do you have a problem with reality as a whole? Right? And I remember many years ago when we used to have barbecues for Freedom Aim, people would come by. We'd have, you know, very interesting chats about philosophy and self-knowledge and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes people would bring up, you know, issues that they had with their own internal states of happiness or motivation or things like that. But I remember one year, this Indian fellow came by and I had to eventually ask him, well, just tell him to leave, because he was almost like hallucinating. Like, and philosophy can't help with hallucinations, right? Philosophy hopefully can help with sort of thinking and reasoning and self-knowledge and truth and so on. Philosophy can help with all of that kind of stuff. But philosophy can't help you. Like if you took LSD and you were seeing, you know, giant iridescent manatees floating through the visual landscape of Dark Side of the Moon, then philosophy couldn't help you, because your entire sensory apparatus is disordered and you're in a state of a waking dream. Like, you know, to take a silly example, we all get psychotic like every night. Every night we have these dreams that are not just detached from reality, they're detached from causality. So, you know, if you're in the forest and you see a Chinese dragon, because you've got some visual disorder hallucinating, but you still see the trees and the trees are real. In dreams, there's nothing that's real, right? It's not like reality plus or minus accuracy, but it is. So like every night, our brain completely detaches from reality and just plays around with a bunch of stuff that is all made up, which we believe at the time. So, quote, nightly psychosis is actually mentally healthy. I think dreams are important and very helpful and healthy. So if you are depressed, that is an internal state, but you're not hallucinating. When psychosis kicks in, right, you hear things that aren't there, you see things that aren't there, and it always seems to be these negative voices telling you to do terrible things. I don't know whether anybody has psychosis where they say, you must now spend the next 20 years curing cancer. It always seems to be kind of negative stuff. So all of this collapse in mental health was going on, and the mother-in-law, right, husband's mother is saying, oh no, she was wonderful, she smiled all the time, she was great, which means that they were keeping it secret, right? Which means that they can't bring negative things to the husband's family. You ever have that with people? If something negative, like genuinely negative, is happening to you. Sometimes there are people in your life who steadfastly don't want to know. Now, if they're Christian and she's hearing, in a sense, demonic voices telling her to harm people, then if you bring that to a Christian mother or mother-in-law, there is a great deal of fear and tension and anxiety, because in the Christian lens, that would be viewed as a kind of demonic possession. And what did you do that was wrong and that was bad? And how are you out of sight or out of sync with Jesus and the Lord, that demons are getting a hold of your consciousness? Like, it's a whole thing you've got to hide. It can't be organic. You got to hide these kinds of sins from your community and those around you. That leaves you very, very isolated. And again, a lot of this is theory. I obviously don't know the religious status of this, but I'll tell you why I think it is this way in a sec. All right. So after the third birth, the symptoms grew in severity. After a period of hypomanic behavior, manic behavior is, I can take on 10 cops, I can fly, I'm going to write the greatest novel in human history in 4 hours, or something like that, right? That is really manic stuff. Hypomanic, it sounds like hypermanic, like even more, but hypomanic is elevated energy and confusion and chaos without actually rising to the definition of mania. And again, please understand, I have to say this because I want to be clear, I'm a complete amateur in all of this stuff. I'm not credentialed in any way. These are just my thoughts. Don't take any of these as facts about mental health and so on. Talk to an expert. These are just my thoughts. So after a period of hypomanic behavior, heightened energy and mood, Lindsay, quote, experienced debilitating anxiety, insomnia, sleeping only approximately 3 hours per night, and exhaustion during the day. She also heard voices and experienced suicidal ideation, right? So she heard voices and experienced suicidal ideation. Now, suicidal ideation is, to my, again, obviously amateur understanding, it's when you're thinking about suicide, you're thinking about dying, but you don't have like a next Thursday. You don't have a plan. You haven't bought a weapon or something like that, right? So that is... that is what. So there's ordinary auditory hallucinations. You're hearing voices, and so on. That is very right. So this is from another article. Despite his wife's suicidal thoughts, the husband said, "We were told by doctors if she doesn't have a plan, and if she's disturbed by the thoughts, then they are probably just thoughts." So if that's true. It's tough. Again, I'm no expert, but I think that if you say, I'm going to do some terrible thing to myself 2 days from now, then maybe you get institutionalized. If you say, well, I'm just thinking about this kind of stuff, then observe and watch and medicate, right? Medication, as it is called. And to me, that kind of self-deletion stuff is also associated with a desire to harm others. Like, if you're willing to harm yourself, you're much more likely to be able to have a desire to harm others. So Lindsay, this is from the article, Lindsay sought help from postpartum mental health specialists, although she was only diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. Now, she insisted she needed to be hospitalized for mental health concerns in December 2022, her husband told this magazine, but she never received a more severe diagnosis. January 1st, 2023, I guess that must have been quite the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf New Year's Eve, right? She was admitted to an inpatient program at a top psychiatric institution, but was discharged after just 5 days. Patrick later confirmed Lindsay had been prescribed and tried more than a dozen medications. We'll get into that in a sec. So according to prosecutors, Lindsay took her daughter to the pediatrician and played in the snow with her children on January 24th, right? So she was admitted first and then let out after 5 days, so on the 6th, I assume. So this is less than 2 weeks later. So she played in the snow with her children on January 24th, 2023, before asking Patrick to pick up takeout for dinner and medication at a nearby pharmacy. She was allegedly fully coherent, according to witnesses. When he returned home, apparently he was only gone for like half an hour, according to some reports. When he returned home, Patrick discovered Lindsay semi-conscious and bleeding outside. She claimed she had tried to jump out a window in a suicide attempt. Inside, Patrick found all three of their children in the home's basement. They allegedly had exercise bands wrapped around their necks. Two of the kids were pronounced dead at the hospital the same day, while Callum was placed on life support but died on January the 27th, so a couple of days later. All three died of, quote, ligature strangulation. So February 7th, Lindsay was arraigned from her bed in a Boston hospital and charged with three counts, each of murder, strangulation, and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. They later dropped the strangulation charges because they said, look, it's sort of pointless if we've already got her on the murder stuff, or charging with the murder stuff. She pleaded not guilty to the charges. The judge ordered her to be held at a medical facility until her treatment following the incident was complete. Months later, In October 2023, Clancy was ordered, this is the mother, to be held without bail and to remain at the hospital. She's still at the facility as she awaits trial. It just gets worse and worse. This whole story just gets worse and worse. She's now a paraplegic and confined to a wheelchair following her suicide attempt. So she jumped from the window. Obviously, she landed badly. Not that you can land well, but she landed badly. And I assume there was spinal damage or whatever it is. So now she's now a paraplegic. So Clancy doesn't deny killing her three children, but has argued in pretrial motions that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time of their deaths, and thus not guilty by an insanity defense. The defense team previously petitioned for a bifurcated trial, with one phase to determine guilt and another for criminal responsibility, and Clancy was reportedly willing to admit to her role in her children's death in writing. So only the second part would be considered. If she's found mentally incompetent, of course, she doesn't go to prison. She goes to a mental health facility until she's cured. This request has been denied, so it will be a standard trial. Sorry, it's absolutely appalling. The poor children. The last thing I want to do is make some kind of tragedy like this about me, but I was basically locked in a small apartment for 2 years with my mother going mad, and she ended up being institutionalized. I nuked her with psychotropics, I assume, and she's never worked again. And it was a dangerous time. I mean, she was like throwing plates. She threw a knife at my head once. So And it's funny, you know, I don't really think about this stuff too much. It's been a long time ago. It has been 45 years, really, since I lived with my mother, with one brief exception. But the poor kids watching their mother go mad. And people who are, quote, losing their minds, just an amateur phrase, of course, people who are losing their minds, extremely dangerous, extremely dangerous. Absolutely volatile, unpredictable. With seemingly no impulse control. That's sort of one of the things that I saw. So it just reminds me, I was older. These kids were, it was all six and under. I was 11. So it was a different kind of situation, but a very dangerous situation. You are dealing with a truly demonic and otherworldly kind of chaos, impulsivity, aggression, and you can't reason with people who are in this kind of state. And I'm not saying that that's a particular fault of theirs, because who knows what's going on in particular, but oof. So just weeks after Lindsay's arraignment, Patrick, the husband, issued a statement saying he had forgiven her and that her passion taught me how to be a better father. That is an astounding thing. That is an astounding thing. So this is another article. So he said his wife, Lindsay, had a condition. He didn't specify what it was, but said their marriage was wonderful and diametrically grew stronger as her condition rapidly worsened. Their marriage improved, got stronger as her condition rapidly worsened. He wrote, "The shock and pain is excruciating and relentless. I'm constantly reminded of them, and with the little sleep I get, I dream about them on repeat." Any parent knows it is impossible to understand how much you will love your kids until you have them. Amen to that. He says the same goes for understanding the devastation of losing them. Cora, Dawson, and Callan were the essence of my life, and I'm completely lost without them. It's wild. Clancy said Cora, quote, had an infectious laugh and was stunningly beautiful. He remembered Dawson's beautiful, bold brown eyes that beamed with friendship, and he called Callan an incredibly happy and vibrant baby, constantly smiling. And again, like, the mother is suffering from catastrophic depression, anxiety, insomnia. And I know it got worse with the last kid. And she's hearing voices and suicidal ideation and so on. I mean, how can the kids be this vibrant and happy and bubbly and enthusiastic and all kinds of wonderful, incredibly happy, constantly smiling? It's the same thing again, constantly smiling. It's the same thing that the mother-in-law said about his wife. He says about the baby. How can you constantly be smiling when your mother is losing her mind and ends up killing you? Callan died with enormous courage despite being so little, Clancy said. Maybe it was his way of demonstrating what I need to do to press forward. I'll always try to draw inspiration from him. He'll always be my little hero. He also shared thoughts about his wife. She's recently been portrayed largely by people who've never met her and never knew who the real Lindsay was. Our marriage was wonderful and diametrically grew stronger as her condition rapidly worsened. I took as much pride in being her husband as I did in being a father, and felt persistently lucky to have her in my life. She strangled your children to death. He remembered her as a loving wife, mother, and nurse, saying she loved being a nurse, but nothing matched her intense love for our kids and dedication to being a mother. It was all she ever wanted. Her passion taught me how to be a better father. I want to ask all of you that you find it deep within yourselves to forgive Lindsay as I have, he said, adding that the real Lindsay was generously loving and caring towards everyone, me, our kids, family, friends, and her patients. The very fibers of her soul are loving. All I wish for her now is that she can somehow find peace. So, I mean, the soul and forgiveness, and so on, very shortly after the incident. You know, I think like all of us, I question myself, and am I too judgmental? Am I too imperious? Am I too heavy-handed and so on? It's incomprehensible to me. It's like the Eric Kirk stuff where she forgives the alleged killer within days of her husband being slaughtered in 4K, thus taking all of the energy out of the legitimate outrage that should have accompanied that murder. I don't think so. I mean, she's not taking responsibility because she's saying it's the postpartum. It's hormones. What? I don't know, right? Like 1 in 7 women go through postpartum, and yet the murder stuff. And if she can fake being normal, my mom was, as she got older, and certainly around the time that she lost her mind, she began to lose the ability to fake being normal, really. So if you can fake being normal, then you know what normal looks like. And if you are having dangerous thoughts towards your children, then you stop caring for them. Like, you take yourself out of being an authority over them. Maybe she had planned all of this, the murder, self-deletion, or whatever. Maybe she planned all of this, and this is why she said, oh, I really want you to go and get some food and pick this up so she would have the time, right? Because I assume that when the husband left, she just went about her dark business. So, So there's some details about the trial, and that to me is less important. And I did look up some of this other stuff that is really important, and this goes back to my sort of criticisms of the psychiatric medical-based industry, where they claim you have a chemical imbalance, but it's never been proven. It's never been proven. They can't find it. They can't find it. So, I'm sorry. I hope the emotions don't bother you. They don't bother me. But I hope that I hope that this doesn't bother you, but it's sort of deep stuff for me. So, you know, she had 3 children under the age of 6. I think she was still working as a nurse. So who was taking care of her children? We don't know. And I don't know if it's going to come out in the trial or anything like that. But to have a full-time job, to have 3 children under the age of, 3 children, 6 and under, and so on, is a catastrophic amount of overwork. A catastrophic amount of overwork. And that is really tough. So this is from Eva Basilian on X. Apparently this woman is paralyzed from the waist down. Not Eva, but the woman, the mother. She wrote her psychosis the mothers took off after the birth of her 3rd child, right before she was scheduled to return to work as a labor and delivery nurse. She was being treated with medication, daily appointments with her doctors, and a stint at the psychiatric hospital. She's the one who begged for help. She committed this crime on the day her husband left the house for half an hour to go get groceries because she seemed to be doing better. The fact that this woman is on trial when she was clearly out of her mind is unconscionable. No, you don't leave a woman who's losing her mind and hearing voices and has suicidal ideation and I've sort of read between 12 and 15 different quote medications. You don't leave her alone with a kid. I mean, in most cultures, women are generally not left alone with newborns. Almost all babies are killed by their mothers. This is not to put any stain on women as a whole, but that's just a statistical fact. And, you know, again, just to be clear, obviously amateur and non-professional take on postpartum depression is if you had a cold, distant, uninvolved, alien life form kind of mother, then you experience significant sorrow and loss and pain, emotional agony, as a baby, because you're reaching out, right? And a baby is very anxious when they're not comforted. Eye contact, skin contact, people smiling at them, delight in their existence and in their presence is essential for babies to feel secure and safe and loved. And if, as a baby, you didn't receive that, then I think you're not aware of that loss because you're a baby, right? So it's essential to your personality, but it doesn't stay in your memories, right? I mean, I don't remember anything before the age of like 10 or 11 months of age. But it's in there, it's hardwired, it's in your soul or your spinal cord or your the base brain, the lizard brain, whatever you want to call it. It's in your essence, that neglect, that distance, right? It's another problem with the poor babies under COVID, right? Only seeing people in masks and so on. It's absolutely awful. So my general theory is that if you had, and some of this might not be the mother's fault, it could be wartime or whatever it is, right? I mean, my grandmother was detonated into atoms in World War II and therefore was obviously unable to give my mother care and comfort at points in her childhood, well, every point thereon. And I mean, that was a war, right? So I'm not putting, but if you had that experience as a baby or that lack of experience of care, nurturing, calm, love, delight, then it stays deep in your heart of hearts. And then when you have a baby, I think it comes back. Because if you have a baby and you look at that baby and you say, I don't know how to love this baby because you weren't loved as a baby yourself. I don't know deep down how to love this baby. I think it brings back the depression of not being loved yourself as a baby. Like most of us don't remember like how we learned language, right? I mean, when we remember learning certain words when we got older and so on. But we don't really remember the process of learning language, but we speak language and we don't really remember the process of being loved or neglected as a baby. And we can avoid that in a way, it probably shows up in other ways, but we can avoid that in a way. Like I can avoid the problem of not speaking Japanese as long as I'm not in Japan and have to speak Japanese. It doesn't really show up, right? And so you have this loss as a baby that you weren't loved. Then the baby comes into your life and you look at that baby and you're like, I do not have the instinctual knowledge of how to love this baby because I myself was not loved as a baby, right? So you love a baby. You're putting deposits into that baby of affection towards that baby you're depositing. And then when that baby grows up and has her own baby, or could be for the case for the man as well, then the new babies take the withdrawal from what you deposited from the mother or the father when they were babies. I mean, just by the by, my brother and I could not be more polar opposites in just about every way. We never really got along, had a lot of conflict. I think one of the differences is he was born in Africa and had a, for at least from what looks like from the photos, a very cold-hearted black nanny. And I was born in Ireland and I had a deeply devoted aunt who cared for me while my mother was in hospital with postpartum depression. My mother went into hospital for months after I was born. And I had such a close bond with my aunt that she later named one of her kids after me. And we just loved each other. And I think that was one of the big differences. It gets kind of hardwired. And then it's not like it's part of your personality, like is your personality. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was able to love the world despite all of that. And of course, my mother would have gone into postpartum depression, I assume, because, you know, she was born right before the Second World War and it was horrendous. And then, you know, the Russian communist grape horde strolled across Germany doing just about everything they wanted to everyone from 7 to 70, every female in general, maybe males too, I'm sure. So if it's like hardwired deep into the soul that you don't know how to love a baby because you weren't yourself loved as a baby. I was loved as a baby, which is why I'm different from literally everyone else in my family, except for one or two aunts, because my parents weren't loved as babies. My brother wasn't loved as a baby. I was left as a baby. It just puts you on a different course and gives you a kind of instinctual benevolence about the world. I think the world is a beautiful place, and I'm immensely happy to be doing what I'm doing. And I could not treasure this conversation more if I was Superman. So, and I have. I have a great capacity for love, and I have a great love towards my wife. I have great love towards friends. I have great love towards my daughter. I think I had a lot of deposits, which is not to fault the people who didn't. It's obviously not your fault if you're not loved as a baby, but, you know, if your parents are depressed or your parents go back to work, right? Your mother goes back to work and she's just not available to love you. And she says, oh, well, you're put into a daycare. They're just not going to love you like your mother would. Some daycare worker. I mean, I worked in a daycare. I mean, we tried to be nice, but we're just not their parents, right? So this next info comes primarily from Lindsay Clancy's January 2026 civil medical malpractice lawsuit against her healthcare providers, cross-referenced with court records, evidence presented at her murder trial, and related reporting. This is from X. 2 months before she killed her children with exercise bands, Lindsay Clancy told her prescriber that she was unable to determine what was real. Disoriented, forgetful, confused, disconnected. They kept writing prescriptions. Here's what she reported and what they gave her in order. Mid-October 2022, a psychiatrist starts her on 25 milligrams of Zoloft. Within days, it's doubled to 50. She reports that she hasn't slept in 48 hours, racing thoughts, worsening anxiety. 20th October 2022, she reports heart palpitations and says her mental health is getting worse. They take her off the Zoloft and prescribe Ativan and Benadryl. Benadryl is, in my obviously amateur view, exceedingly demonic juice. 16th November, she goes into the ER with insomnia, anxiety, and heart palpitations. She's sent home with Trazodone. 20th November, her mother-in-law rings a perinatal behavioral health program. Lindsay tells them she's very frustrated, scared, with extreme insomnia and racing thoughts. They prescribe Prozac. And when my mother came out of the asylum, man, there was just a smoking crater where her mind used to be. Fourth November, she reports the Prozac is making her insomnia worse. So, they add Ambien, Remeron, and Clonopin. Three more on top. The very next day, she tells the practitioner she is unable to determine what's real. Disoriented, forgetful, confused, disconnected. Nobody stops. 28th November, she's getting 3 hours of sleep, disoriented and scared. They prescribed Seroquel. Her husband testified last week that this is where, quote, her big spiral started. 2nd December, she reports she's suicidal and hearing things. 3 days later, she rings a crisis hotline asking to be admitted. She's told she doesn't meet the criteria. I mean, this is like the murder before the murders, right? 6th December, she and Patrick go back to the practitioner together. He tells them she's far worse since starting the Seroquel. They increase the dose. 28th December, back to the ER, suicidal. The next day, she admits herself into a program and is removed because the doctor says she's just over-medicated and doesn't have a mental health issue. She admits herself to a different hospital. She's discharged with Trazodone. 10th January, a psychiatrist prescribes Valium, then amitriptyline. 24th January, she reported hearing a male voice say, "This is your last chance. Kill the children so you can yourself." Her kids were 5, 3, and 8 months. So that's 11 psychiatric drugs in 4 months. She reported it was getting worse every single stage. Every single time the answer was more drugs, more drugs, more drugs. How many of these drugs have been tested relative to placebo, relative to combinations, long-term effects? All these drugs in combinations at these doses, have they been tested against placebo? Of course not. According to this ex post, not one person in that chain asked whether the treatment had become the illness. Well, it's not quite true because one of the doctors says she's over-medicated. This is from the ex post. "This was not a mysterious psychiatric event appearing out of nowhere. It was a progressive collapse of brain function under postpartum stress, extreme insomnia, autonomic overdrive, and relentless pharmacological interference." The warning signs were explicit: racing thoughts, palpitations, worsening anxiety, disorientation, derealization, suicidality, and hallucinations. Yet every sign of deterioration was interpreted as a reason to add, switch, or increase another drug. You know, when I met my wife, and she said she worked in mental health, I was like, "Please don't be a psychiatrist. Please don't be a psychiatrist." And she said, no, I practice psychology. I've been doing it for many years." I was like, "Oh." I said, "Oh, what do you think of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is reasoning with people?" And she's like, "It's great." And I'm like, "You are not a pusher. God damn the pusher men." This ex post, I'm not saying I agree with all of this, but it's good perspective. "Psychiatry cannot keep pretending that SSRIs, benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, sedating antidepressants, and hypnotics are inert tools with no capacity to induce activation, akathisia, paradoxical reactions, delirium, withdrawal states, or psychosis. These outcomes are documented." Akathisia is a sort of skin crawling thing. No capacity to relax or concentrate, like ants crawling through your skin. I think Jordan Peterson went through that after his benzos. "Paradoxical reactions, which is you treat someone for anxiety, their anxiety gets worse. Delirium, withdrawal states, derealization, which is where you just don't feel real. You feel like you're living in a movie. You don't feel like anything's real, the people aren't real, and so on. These outcomes are documented," says the ex-post, "and this is not the first time in which severe behavioral disintegration followed escalating psychiatric polypharmacy," which is just piling drugs upon drugs upon drugs. "The most disturbing fact is not that one clinician made one mistake, but that an entire system repeatedly watched her lose contact with reality and still treated the worsening condition as proof that she needed more chemical suppression. At some point, the treatment became part of the disease. The establishment does not want that sentence said out loud, which is exactly why it needs to be said louder." We are just our brains. And when they mess with your brain, they are messing with yourself. This is true for propaganda. These kinds of intense drugs of doubtful scientific benefit. I mean, the biggest and best treatment for depression is dancing. Statistically, look that up. It's true. But who profits from you shaking your tail feather to Pete Townsend's face to face, right? Who profits from that? My wife, this guy, the husband, right? And it's easy for me to say, and I say this with sympathy to them. They are in the world of the media, they're in the world of general NPC cause and effect. Oh, it's a chemical imbalance. We'll fix it with this. It's like insulin for diabetes, so, you know, you wouldn't be ashamed of that, and so on. But if it is a malaise of the soul that arises from a lack of love, carpet bombing the brain with random stimulants and suppressants, putting you on the Elvis pills to go to sleep, pills to wake you up kind of diet, is not going to solve that. And of course, the great temptation, if you are facing a spiritual crisis, a crisis of meaning, a crisis of virtue, a crisis of morality and corruption. I know this personally, and I'm not trying to say I'm a template for everyone. I'm just telling you my experience that I was embedded in corrupt relationships. And I ceased being able to sleep. And this went on for 16 months. I refused to go to a psychiatrist, incomprehensible to me. And I refused to get sleeping pills. And I exercised a lot. I began to, and it felt like pulling limbs off. I began to pull away the corrupt relationships, to pull away from them too. And it felt like I was wandering into the desert from the only human settlement to die among the dunes and the bones. There was no oasis out there, nothing better. It's horrendous. And I went to therapy. I tried one therapist, didn't work, tried another therapist. It took. And I did, I did almost 2 years in talk therapy, 3 hours a week, plus another. Most therapy work takes place outside the office. So I did 3 hours a week, an hour and a half, Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I did 6 to 8 hours of journaling. No meds. Raw dogging. A confrontation with my own capacity to place proximity above virtue. To say, well, I'm getting well paid in the business world, and I have these historical relationships, and I have places to go at Christmas, and I was in a relationship. I was engaged to a woman, and I ended up breaking off that engagement and moving out, which was a significant investment and huge change. And it felt like I was going to some internal bone doctor that said, "Hey, you know the solution to what you're doing? Just peel your skin off. Yeah, just peel your skin off, and you'll be much better." And it's a horrendous process to go through. I mean, massively, unbelievably, immensely, deeply beneficial. But if you're going through, and I don't know if this woman was going through a moral crisis, obviously I don't know. The facts may come out, they may not come out, I don't know. I doubt they will. But the first place that I really tried to look into, which was a brutal process, when I was sleepless and unhappy. Well, I wouldn't say the first place. Let me not praise myself unjustly in that way. I looked for a bunch of things, but where I landed was that the reason I couldn't sleep was that I was morally sleepwalking through life. I had virtues and values from the age of 15 to 30. So all of my adult life, I had virtues and values that were not being manifested in my relationships. And to place virtue above history, momentum, the easy relationship socialism of who you're born with and who you grew up with, right? Who you go to school with and who you're born with, your family and so on. That's kind of like socialism. It's a subsidy. It's not bad. If they're good people, it's fantastic. But if they're not particularly good people, then it is an unjust subsidy And what happens is when you have not good people around you, the good people avoid you. Right? I mean, if you see someone coughing blood, I mean, surrounded by medics, you won't walk through that, or you'll walk around, right? In a dangerous way. You don't want to get infected. So I had this sort of moat of semi-lucid corruption around me that was keeping all the good people away. And my unconscious was done with it. Just done. No more. We don't need it. We can survive without it. And it began the process of like trying to pull a frozen mastodon out of a prehistoric frozen tar pit. It's just chip, 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 pull, pull. It feels like an impossible task. And then you're free. And then life gets so much better. Not easy. It's not easy. But that kind of moral crisis, a spiritual crisis, a crisis of virtue, it's very tempting for some people. And look, I'm not, oh, I was so brave. I'm just telling you, like, I wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't do it. And for a lot of people, though, if somebody says, you don't need to look at the empathy, compassion, virtue, integrity, and honesty, and morals of those around you, just take a pill. Just take a pill. And you'll be fine. And if you're diabetic and you need insulin, nobody would say, ah, but you need to spend a year or two going through a moral trough and crisis, hit bottom, and then rebuild yourself up, and then your diabetes will be better, right? So the normie, it's like the offer has to be matched by the desire, right? The drug dealer, to use an analogy in a different context, the drug dealer can only offer you drugs. He can't force you to take them. There has to be a demand as well. And if it turns out that this is a very Christian family, then the idea that there could be coldness and distance from babies that may have contributed or even caused or triggered postpartum depression, which then leads to not saying, gee, I wonder why I get depressed every time I have a baby. And here's the thing too. Again, I can't say anything about this family. What do I know? But if you were neglected or harmed, a lot of people torment and torture babies. If you were neglected or harmed as a baby alone in the house with your mother, or it could be a daycare worker, or it could be a babysitter, or it could be an aunt, it could be a grandmother, anything. Right? If you were harmed as a baby, the only witness that remains alive is the deficiency of your instincts. And that's not proof, right? That's not proof. If you're neglected as a baby, the only witness is someone who will never confess. I mean, if your mother is cold or your father is cold or both, are they going to say, oh yeah, no, I was very cold to you as a baby? I mean, some parents will say that later on, you know, like the parents who were like, I would have been so much better off without you. I don't like you. I wish you'd never been here. I wish you'd never been born. All of that stuff indicates, of course, profound hostility and wounded people, of course, but also selfish people. Selfish people, when you have a baby, you have to put your needs, your ego, your preferences aside and devote yourself to the baby. I say this as a stay-at-home dad of almost 18 years. You have to take everything about yourself and your particular preferences, and you have to devote yourself to the well-being of your children. That's really tough. For narcissistic people, well, it's pretty much impossible, I think, at that point. Selfish people and so on, they resent the baby. Like, you know, it's Friday night and you got a great party to go to where you want to meet this girl, and then your boss gives you like a massive amount of work and says you got to work late. You just feel this annoyance, like I've got to want to get to this party as much. Now my mother had this too. My mother was my mother had this belief that she would like be some movie star or something. She was very pretty, right? The red carpet, and she'd have this life of elegance and luxury. And but if it wasn't for these gosh darn kids, you know, like Scooby Doo style, these gosh darn kids that get in the way, is why she would say that she hated us from time to time. Because we were in the way of her getting you know, Cary Grant or an Oscar or whatever it was that she had imagined her life would be like without children. And so of course, if you have these fantasies that you can have this amazing, wonderful, perfect life, if it wasn't for this baby or these kids, or then it's very tough. It's very tough for you to take pleasure in the ego abandonment and service of another, which is a baby. I mean, even from a practical standpoint, everything you withhold from your babies when they're young, you pay for 10 times over when they become teenagers. And when you become old and they dump you in a home or something or don't come to visit. You know, parenting is, as I've said a million times, is very much devoted to the teenage years. And everything you deposit and every deferral of gratification you achieve to make your babies happier and healthier and full of joy and feeling truly loved and treasured, all of that comes back to you tenfold as teenagers, and then watching them move into adulthood with grace and dignity and virtue and purpose. Wonderful. Everything you withhold from your babies, they will mostly, usually, and somewhat instinctually make you pay for when they hit their teenage years, because they don't have loyalty to you because you didn't have love for them, and therefore they get loyalty to TikTok, their peers, the media, and you lose them to the sociopaths who use pixels to promote propaganda. I don't know, obviously, what's going on in this family. There are vague hints that I wanted to use as a way to talk about this more. Of course, you don't leave a woman who's going through hearing voices, derealization, psychotic episodes. Of course, you don't leave her alone with children. I don't know why that would happen. Is he morally responsible? It's tough. It's tough. It's tough. Of course, society as a whole doesn't talk about the dangers that some women pose to their own babies. Again, child murder, very much female, baby murder, almost exclusively female. Obviously, it's rare. I understand that. It's rare. But, you know, grape is rare, but apparently we live in a grape culture. So we're not alert and aware to the dangers of women, because women are wonderful, women are amazing, women blah, 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 right? So there's a lot of failures that lead up to something like this. Was it a failure of her mother to love her, thus lending her prone to depression and anxiety when she realizes, because she was not loved as a baby, she doesn't know how to love her own babies and doesn't want to face that she wasn't loved as a baby because she has a sentimental relationship with her own mother who praises her constantly in order to distract her from criticizing her mother's coldness? I don't know. And we'll probably never know. These are just theories, of course. I think they match the facts, but that doesn't mean that's proof. Dark matter matches the facts of the universe. That doesn't mean that dark matter is proven. It's just a fudge factor. So, love your babies. If you weren't loved as a baby, if you have a cold parent, you need to deal with that before you have babies. A lot of what we see as mental health or psychological crises are moral issues. Surrounded by people who lie, who fake, who pretend, who are corrupt, who exploit, who are not reciprocal, who bully, who threaten, who withdraw, who manipulate. There's a lot of squid-based life forms out there picking your spiritual pockets with every tentacle at their disposal and some that they can borrow. If you are surrounded by good people, it is very hard for you to come to any kind of harm. If you're surrounded by not so good people, it's almost impossible for you to do any good. Reason equals virtue equals happiness. There's no way to break that chain. Thank you.